For the week of October 21st, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 168, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
It's once again time for Showbiz Sandbox, Michael, where we let all of our listeners know what's going on in the entertainment industry. We do this so that they don't have to read, what, The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Entertainment Weekly.
Well, they can read them, but we tell them the real truth, the real story.
That's true. It's not that our listeners can't read. It's that, you know, they may not have the time to read.
And you haven't been feeling like reading very much lately, have you? Tell them you're not feeling well.
No, I'm not feeling very well. I've been quite sick. But I said, Michael, it doesn't matter whether I can talk or not talk, whether I have a sore throat or no sore throat, whether I'm breathing or not breathing. We have to bring our listeners the entertainment news. It is a matter of great national and international importance.
And like your wife, I like it better when you can't talk back. So tell us, what are we going to cover this week?
Well, on today's show, we'll try and find out what's happening with the new television season, or really more specifically, what's not happening, since apparently broadcast networks have seen a huge decline in viewership. We're going to reveal the secret reason as to why this is, so stick around. I'm going to give you a hint. Think zombies. We also take a look at whether you own all the movies and music you're purchasing from iTunes, Amazon, and Google. The answer is absolutely maybe not. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilt, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the box office, of course, covers the entire box office from the world. We don't just cover North America. We cover the entire world. We pull together all the information we can from all our resources, and we tell you what's actually happening around the globe.
And let me translate that for our listeners in international markets. What Michael means when he says that is we call every single theater individually and spend the weekend adding up all their ticket sales.
That's right. And after that exhaustive survey, we know that the number one movie around the world this weekend was Paranormal Activity 4. It grossed $65 million worldwide. It cost about $5 million to make, so you won't be surprised to know that they've already scheduled Paranormal Activity 5.
That's true. Although I guess what the reviews on this were basically, we've seen it before, about three times before, in fact.
Well, the audience polls and scores were pretty vicious. Even fans of the series, the last guy I spoke to said, well, Paranormal Activity 3 was the best, he says. This one was pretty lame. It got pretty negative reviews, even for a slapdash, low-budget horror flick like this one. So, not good reviews, not that it matters. They've still got enough room for Paranormal Activity 5 and 6 before it runs out of steam. And number two around the world is Taken 2, the Liam Neeson action film. It grossed $37 million. It's at $281 million worldwide and counting. And number three, the Adam Sandler animated film Hotel Transylvania. That grossed $28 million. It's at $187 million, most of that in North America. Obviously, they're opening it pretty quickly around the globe because they want to get in before Halloween. That's a bigger holiday here in North America than it is in a lot of countries, but it has grown bigger over the years in the UK and elsewhere, so naturally they want to cash in before that season is passed.
From what I've been told in Scandinavia, they're like, Hala what?
Yes, exactly. At number four is the Ben Affleck film Argo, which had a terrific hold its second weekend in North America and expanded into a few small territories around the globe. It made $18 million this weekend. It's at $44 million and counting. It playing great to everybody. I saw it over the weekend, and the audience applauded twice during the closing credits, once when the credits began and again when the credits were just about to end. I haven't seen that in a long, long time. People really love this movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I mean, it only dropped 14.6%. I can't remember a time where a movie dropped only that little. Granted, sometimes they increase, but 14.6%, that's a really good drop. And then just last night, right after the big debates, the political debates here, I was watching South Park, the very end of South Park, waiting for The Daily Show to start. And they're mentioning Argo on South Park. This is an animated show, and I'm thinking to myself, how is it that they're able to do this 2 weeks after the movie is released? It's animated.
Well, they make it that week.
I know. I am amazed.
Yeah, this week they're making the show that will air next Wednesday, a week from this Wednesday. So that's how they stay timely. At number five around the world is Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted. It made another $15 million, and it just passed the $700 million mark. And number six is a new film in North America, Alex Cross, the reboot of a franchise that starred Morgan Freeman. This time it stars Tyler Perry in his biggest film that he didn't write and direct. He clearly did not bring the Madea crowd along with him. It grossed $11 million. Not very good.
And this was its worldwide debut, right? I mean, it debuted,
yes. Yeah. It debuted in North America only. No Tyler Perry film, I believe, has ever opened overseas. I don't know whether this might be the one that changes that. It's possible because the other Alex Cross movies did open overseas a little bit. Maybe this one will finally be the film to introduce Tyler Perry to the rest of the world. And number seven is Sinister, the horror film starring Ethan Hawke. It grossed $9 million. It's at $31 million and counting. And number eight is a four-way tie, four different films, all of which grossed $8 million. There's Here Comes the Boom, the Kevin James film, which had a soft opening and has now made $23 million to date. There's Ted, which is at $481 million worldwide, about to pass the half-billion-dollar mark. There's the Spanish film The Impossible, which is in the English language, but it's a film directed by a Spanish director and opened in Spain. It stars Ewan McGregor and Naomi Watts. It's grossed another $8 million. It's at $25 million and counting. A terrific blockbuster for that country. And there's the Tim Burton film Frankenweenie, which grossed $8 million, and it's at $40 million worldwide. Very modest takings for that stop-motion animated film. And then at number 12, there's a two-way tie, two more films that grossed $7 million. One of them is Asterisk and Obelix. It's the fourth film in that franchise. It's called At Service to Your Majesty. This series stars Gerard Depardieu. It's based on a beloved comic strip or graphic novel series. Everybody in Europe knows and loves Asterisk and Obelix, just like they love Tintin. They mean nothing to us in North America. I don't even know if they've bothered to release the last one or two here in the States, but it's still a blockbuster franchise in Europe. And the other film to gross $7 million this weekend is Pitch Perfect, Glee Goes to College, which is a very successful comedy, which has done quite well. It's at almost $50 million. They've done a terrific job of platforming this movie out.
And, you know, if you can actually get a copy of Asterisk and Obelix, I can't pronounce that today. I don't know why. But, you know, at least see the first one. It's worth catching.
Did you ever read the comic strips or the comic books?
And those are actually really worth reading, yes.
Yeah, I would say get those. Skip the movie and go right to the
books. Okay, that's kind of what I meant. But, you know, and I'm surprised, Michael, that you kind of ran right past Sinister, which is this horror film. And when I saw this film with Ethan Hawke, I didn't see the film, but when I saw that it was being released, and I thought, well, why are they making another horror film like that? You know, that's so kind of generic in a way. You said it made how much did it make?
It's now a total of $32 million.
Yeah, $32 million. And then how much did it cost to make?
$3 million.
And that's why they keep making those movies.
That's right. And that came from Summit, which is having a very good week, mostly. It's a small studio, small distributor. It has three films in release right now. One is Sinister, which cost nothing to make and made $32 million. So that's a success. Another of their movies is Alex Cross, which has not done that well. We'll have to see how it holds the second weekend, but it doesn't look promising. The third film is also a success. It's The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which we've talked about quite a bit. It held rock steady in its fifth weekend. It grossed another $2 million in North America. It's at $9 million and counting. So they're really building that film into a word-of-mouth hit. So two out of three is very good, and Summit is having a good week.
And of course, they're going to be releasing a little film later on this year. It has something to do with like sunset or sunrise. I can't remember. Something about twilight. That's it.
Yes, that's right. So they're proving they're not a one-trick pony. They're finally having some success beyond the Twilight franchise.
Yes.
Also in limited release is The Sessions, the Oscar hopeful that stars Helen Hunt and John Hawkes. It opened on four screens and grossed a very strong $30,000 per screen average. So that's a very successful launch for them. They just have to hope fans spread the word and love the movie and that people will show up when they expand it wider down the road. Moonrise Kingdom is still in theaters. I was interested to see. It's been in the theaters for 22 weeks. That's over 5 months. It's grossed $63 million worldwide, and it's still playing in one or two screens as it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray this week. I finally caught up with it, and if you like Wes Anderson, you're going to like this movie.
That is very correct.
If you find it twee and annoying, stay away.
That's right. If you find Wes Anderson, as Michael said, twee and annoying, you will hate this movie. And it really is true that, you know, Wes Anderson is the new Woody Allen. You know, his movies are playing for, you know, umpteen months, and you know, they play right through to the point where the movie comes out on home video.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what the budget to success ratio was, but he's a good bet as far as, you know, modestly budgeted movies. As long as he can keep his costs down, he seems like he's going to be able to keep making whatever movie he wants.
Well, I mean, Woody Allen's been making movies for decades now. I don't see why the joke there was, because I mentioned Woody Allen and you... Yes, I have my little sound effects box now.
I feel like I'm on a morning zoo show.
Okay, well, we better switch gears then pretty darn quickly.
All right, well, let's move on to television.
All right, well, I know in television you wanted to talk about how great television is these days, how you love turning it on and watching all the new shows and how the ratings are through the roof.
Well, some of that's true. Television is great. There's a lot of good television, but unfortunately, a lot of it is on cable. The hot shows right now are Boss and Breaking Bad and Homeland. These are the shows that people talk about as being among the best on television right now. And of course, The Walking Dead on AMC, which is a blockbuster hit. Unfortunately, we've had a new fall season and the major networks are introducing a lot of shows and people are not turning up. So it just depends how you want to emphasize it. Do you want to emphasize that NBC is having an unexpectedly good start to the fall season? Or do you want to start with the fact that network TV is collapsing?
Well, I think what's really important is that network TV is collapsing. Out of that, NBC happens to be doing the best of the networks, which is surprising since they were in fourth place last year.
Right. They're doing well if all you care about is the 18 to 49-year-old demographic.
That's
and unless
right.
you're an advertiser, why would you be like that? Why would you care? You know, CBS is actually winning week after week, and ABC is doing really well. NBC is not suddenly number one in the ratings. They're just number one in the key demo that matters most to advertisers. That's because of a couple reasons. One, Sunday Night Football, which is the number one show in the country and a massive hit. Two, The Voice, the singing competition, which NBC has now double pumping. They're using it in the spring as they have before, and now they're using it in the fall as well, which means this is the first singing competition to air twice a year. That's something Simon Cowell always avoided on American Idol and doesn't do with The X Factor. But now NBC is doing it with The Voice, and it's working. It's been a big hit in the fall.
In fact, The Voice is kind of like pummeling The X Factor, which is on right now.
No, The X Factor is Fox's number one show right now. So I wouldn't say that they're not head-to-head. They're on different nights. Voice is certainly ranking higher, as it has always. But they're both flourishing. They're both doing well.
No, that's good. I mean, so effectively, they're doing what's called two arcs. And an arc in a reality show or one of these competition shows is a whole set of shows. So it's a whole competition, if you will.
Right. They have a full complete season from beginning to end where they
right.
crown a winner. So you've seen that on Survivor, Amazing Race, and other shows. But in singing competitions, the fear was that you're really going to not have enough talent to spread it out. You're going to blur the excitement of building up to a new, discovering a new star. It's just not the same as a competition show where, you know, you're the last on the island. But The Voice has ignored that. They've launched their fall edition and it's doing well. But both episodes are in the top 10. They are Mondays for 2 hours and Tuesdays for 1 hour, and they're doing great. And that means the shows that follow them have a chance to do well. On Monday nights, NBC introduced Revolution, which is doing very well. It's one of the top rated new shows of the season, thanks to its huge lead in. And on Tuesdays, they've introduced two sitcoms, Go On, the Matthew Perry Show, and The New Normal. And then Tuesdays at 10 is Parenthood, which is in its fourth season. So all that combined means that NBC is doing very well and winning the race for the first 3 weeks in that key 18 to 49 demo. In fact, they're up 15% over last year. ABC, however, is down 12%. Fox is down 19%. And CBS is down 24%.
And yet CBS has more viewers.
A lot more viewers. So NBC had nowhere to go but up because they were so far down.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, they've been struggling for years. They have had programming issues. They had Ben Silverman in for a while, and that didn't work out too well. And that kind of drove that really drove everything into the ground. And Jeff Zucker was running he was running all of NBC Universal and made that horrible mistake of putting Jay Leno on at 10, which kind of had a ripple effect right through, at least a good year or two. And they were in fourth place last year. And they hired Robert Greenblatt, to come in from, Showtime. And he came in as the programming executive. And he's really turned things around. He said at the very beginning, I want to win one night and compete in another. That was kind of an easy statement to say because he knew he was going to win Sunday night because he had football, at least in the first part of the season. And he wanted to compete on Monday nights. Well, he's winning both Monday and Tuesday. Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Yeah. So he's winning 3 days in a row, at least in the 18 to 49 year old demographics, which is really saying something. They hadn't
right.
done that since, I think, 2002.
Been a long time. So the other, it is growing, but also the other networks have collapsed in that demo. I mean, down 24% is a huge fall. So it's not just that NBC is doing better, it's that other networks are doing more poorly. But how strong is their success? How strong of a base do they have? Well, let's look at the shows in particular. The Voice, again, this is they're playing it twice a year, and that's very dangerous. Remember what happened to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? That was a game changer for ABC, a massive popular success, and they burned it out by airing it constantly year round. If that could have been a long-term franchise for the network, and instead they burned it out in about 3 years and really squandered the opportunity to launch a lot of shows behind it.
And I think that happens a lot with these game shows. What's the Howie Mandel one? Not Let's Make a Deal, but like What's in My Suitcase?
Yeah.
The deal or No Deal. I think they're burning, or they did burn that
out. Well, that's gone, yeah. Well, not that was nowhere near the hit that Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is, and nor is it as big a hit as The Voice. But airing it twice a year, you can already see they don't have a lot of great singers on the show. The talent on The X Factor is a lot better. They're not going to have the judges for the next round. It's going to be different. It's going to be two new judges mixed in there. And frankly, the whole appeal of the show is the four judges, much more so than The X Factor, where the appeal is more about the talent as well as the judges. On this show, it's all about the judges joking with each other, teasing each other, stealing contestants from each other. It's all about that dynamic. And so removing two of them so that you can air it year-round is very, very risky. So I think they've had a short-term success with The Voice, but they could be paying the price 2 years down the road. Then you have Revolution at 10 o'clock on Monday night. It ranks third in the hour behind Castle on ABC and Hawaii Five-0 on CBS. But of course, advertisers don't care about old people or young people. They only care about those people in that sweet spot of 18 to 49. However, Revolution is losing more than 30% of its lead-in.
Well, and you know, you said this was a horrible show. And
I hate it. It's terrible.
And I thought it would be off the air in no time. It gets picked up for the full season. And now, out of the five episodes that I have on my TiVo, I'm going to have to watch them.
Well, just because I said it's not a good show didn't mean I think it would be off the air necessarily. Well, I mean, there are bad shows that last for decades. Look at, you know, Two and a Half Men. That's a terrible show.
Well, I suppose maybe I was hoping it would be canceled, so therefore I could just delete it off the DVR and not worry about it.
That's right. But losing more than 30% of your intro is not the sign of a great success. In this day and age, I guess it's not so bad as long as you have that key demo, the number one in that demo against Hawaii Five-0 and Castle, either which I think is a better show. Not by much, but, you know, I like Castle. Hawaii Five-0 is whatever. It's just sort of generic programming. But Revolution, you know, it's got a complicated backstory. We'll have to see whether they need to, you know, they've got this slot. They've launched the show. I say, is this a long-term hit? I don't know. I would say you haven't really proven yourself. Move it to another night. See if it can survive next season. If it doesn't, you're not going to waste that slot. You want to have a show there that's an actual blockbuster hit. You're wasting your most valuable slot with a show that can't hold on to its lead-in and can't even beat the other two shows in, you know, in the ratings.
Well, I wonder, what are the other shows in that hour, Monday, 10
o'clock? I said Castle and Hawaii Five-0.
No. Are they dropping 30% of their lead-in as well? In other words, is 10 o'clock just a dead hour? Because it really is. It tends to be a bit of a dead hour.
Dropping 30% is never a good sign. Doesn't matter what hour of the night it is. There are shows at 10 o'clock, like Chicago Fire holds on to a lot of its lead-in on, I think that's Wednesday night, from Law & Order SVU. So no, there's no rule of law that says if you're at 10 o'clock, you're going to lose a bunch of your audience. That's just not the case.
Well, what about some other shows?
Well, they have, on Tuesdays, they've launched Go On. That's the Matthew Perry show. It and The New Normal rank third from 9 to 10 p.m. Go On loses almost 50% of The Voice lead-in. And The New Normal loses 30% of Go On.
And yet, so Go On is considered literally the comedy hit, the sitcom half-hour comedy hit of the season.
No, it's not, because there are no comedy hits from this season. Nobody says it's a big comedy hit, because there is zero comedy hits from this season. No, there's one new drama in the top 20. That's Vegas on CBS. There's no new massive big hit comedy the way there was of, say, The New Girl, or Two Broke Girls in recent years, that, or Modern Family. There's nothing like that this season, and that's certainly not Go On.
According to
but if you're losing more than 50% of your lead-in, you're not a smash hit.
Well,
nobody thinks that.
New York Times says, look, if you're trying to find a hit here, Ben and Kate, no. 2.7 million viewers for its latest episode, not a big hit. The Mindy Project, yeah, they're 3.6 million viewers, down from 4.7 million from its premiere. And Go On, really, just based on viewership, might be considered the only big comedic hit, if you want to consider its numbers a hit.
Well, that's a lot of caveats. It's not a hit, and there are no hit sitcoms this season. Nobody has launched a successful new sitcom.
Well, let me say
Go
this.
Go On is certainly not it. It loses over 50% of its lead-in. That's a huge waste, and it can't last. They're going to have to move it and try to get a show in there. You know, that'll stay there this season, but if they keep it there, they're squandering that huge lead-in where you can really build a blockbuster night with a show that's not doing well and not appealing to viewers.
Then let me put it another way. Which is, by the way, the exact way that the New York Times put it, which was that Go On is the highest rated new comedy of the season at 6.7 million viewers per episode. So it doesn't say
simply because
biggest hit, it says
but
highest
it's losing,
rated.
It's losing, it is the highest rated, and it's losing more than 50% of the lead-in from the 12 or 13 million viewers that watch The Voice. That's not a success.
Yeah, well, I would tend to agree with you on that.
Right, NCIS Los Angeles and Dancing with the Stars, the results show, essentially double the viewers of those two sitcoms. And they give such a huge lead in on that demo that they're still overall winning the night, but they're not doing a great job. At 10 o'clock on Tuesday's Parenthood. It's the fourth season for the show. It's always been low rated, but it is pretty demo friendly. It draws very good demos and very wealthy, educated people. That's why it's still on the air 4 years in, even though it's third in its hour and not doing great. It barely even beats Univision at 10 o'clock.
Well, to all of this, I would say Parenthood is still on the air.
Right. It ranks behind Vegas, which is the biggest new drama hit of the year. That show stars Dennis Quaid and Michael Chiklis. And it ranks behind the just-canceled Grey's Anatomy spinoff Private Practice. However, Parenthood improves on its lead-in, The New Normal. That's how bad The New Normal is doing. So you have Go On losing more than 50%, New Normal dropping 80% from what The Voice 830 lead-in is, and then you have Parenthood piping up a bit and showing a little signs of life because The New Normal is doing so poorly. So basically, NBC's success boils down to 3 hours of The Voice doing very well and both ranking the top 10. That's like getting three new hit dramas, or say two new hit dramas and two hit sitcoms, all in one fell swoop just by repeating a reality show hit in the fall. So in fact, no new shows for NBC rank, no new shows from anyone rank in the top 10, and only two rank in the top 30. Those are Vegas and Nashville. So, you know, NBC's winning Sunday in every level, and it's winning Monday and Tuesday in that key demo, but it's doing it all on the back of one show when it comes to Monday and Tuesday, and that's The Voice. And I think 2 years down the road, if they don't use those slots to try and launch some successful shows, they're going to have squandered their chance. You know, they're going to burn out The Voice and squander the chance to launch some new hits.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and people ask, well, why would NBC pay billions of dollars for the Olympics and then kind of go in and possibly even lose money? Well, it turns out they didn't lose money this time around. They actually, I think, broke even or made a small profit. But the reason to do something like that is because what were they doing during the Olympics? They were advertising all of their new fall shows again and again and again. And in a small part, it paid off because some of these shows are actually getting some viewers, at least in key demographics.
I disagree. If you're following The Voice, you're gonna get you can lose 50% of your audience and still have a good demographic because you're following the biggest hit NBC has in other than football. You know, this is the only slot where you can have a show follow the massive hit of The Voice. Those are Mondays at 10 and Tuesdays at 9. And Go On is going to get sampled and rejected. And I don't think it needed to be sampled because it had Olympic ads. If you put it after The Voice, people are going to see it. It's Matthew Perry, a sitcom. You need to spend a couple $1 billion to buy the Olympics in order to say Matthew Perry has a new sitcom and it follows our biggest hit show, The Voice. So, hey, maybe you should check it out.
So what you're saying is there are cheaper ways to market your new programming.
Absolutely. 2 weeks of the Olympics is not worth the, you know, I don't buy that.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, again, this is what the industry would have you believe, or at least certain members
it's what
of
the Olympics
media
would have you believe.
Certain members of the, well, certainly what NBC would try to make you believe.
Well, they certainly don't want to say they wasted their money. Animal Practice was introduced during the Olympics. That's already been canceled.
I know.
You have to have good shows. If you have good shows, giving the platform the Olympics can only help. If you have a bad show, it's not going to make a darn bit of difference.
Well, let's talk about some of these shows then. We talked about some of the shows on NBC. Let's talk about some of the shows, some of these new shows on what, ABC, CBS?
Well, first, let's explain, you know, is NBC doing great or is network television doing poorly?
And I think it's the latter.
Is doing poorly because all the excitement is on cable.
Right,
Walking
I would agree.
Dead has been out for 2 weeks now. It's the biggest cable drama hit in basic cable history. It's matching The Sopranos in its level of growth. It reached 10.9 million viewers on its season premiere. It reached another, 9.5 million in its second episode. So it had a great hold. If you add in the DVR and all that delayed viewing and episodes that aired later in the night and reruns, it reached 15 million people on its premiere episode, another 14 million for its second episode. These are huge numbers. These are just blockbuster numbers. Just like The Sopranos, it's been growing by leaps and bounds every season. It hasn't peaked yet. The Sopranos peaked in its fourth year, so there's a possibility we could see if The Walking Dead matches that. It could grow next year as well. I've been watching it. It's a lot of fun. It is the number one show. If all you care about is the 1849 demo, it is the number one drama, period.
Wow.
It is the number one show, period. Its viewers are all in the 18 to 49 demo. Maybe, I guess, old people don't like all the gore.
Well, and it is a show about zombies. We should say, remember we said think zombies? Well, this is the show that is about zombies. And I think zombies care about more than the 18 to 49 demographic. They're not prejudiced against anyone.
They'll eat anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but you think of The Walking Dead and Boss and Homeland and Sons of Anarchy and American Horror Story and Archer and South Park. All the quality drama, all the quality sitcoms that are coming out right now are on cable. There's not a single new show on the networks that I'm excited by. I've sampled virtually all of them. One or two are okay. I'm sort of still watching a few, but none of them are must-watch TV for me. But on cable, I've got a backlist of shows I need to watch. I need to catch up on Boss. I need to catch up on Homeland. And I'm going to, and I'm excited to do that. I have four seasons of Sons of Anarchy to watch. I can't wait to do it. This is where all the excitement and the ratings are. And when you've got a couple hundred channels and a lot of quality television on a lot of different channels, that obviously chips away at network television.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'm trying to think in my own mind, okay, so what am I watching? And I realize now that a show that I've been DVRing, if that's a word, I think I may have just made that up. It's, you know, on the TiVo is on BBC America, is Copper, which just got picked up for another season.
Copper is the first BBC America original series. It's set in New York, I think, in the early 1900s or the 1800s.
It's set during the Civil War, so the 1860s.
With the race riots in New York. Very exciting. I just got that on DVD. I'm looking forward to checking that out. And, you know, it's one of the many, many shows that are on cable that are worth watching.
What's notable about Copper is, okay, it's a halfway decent show and pretty good. But also, you're talking about Tom Fontana and Barry Levinson. These are the executive producers and creators of the show. So it's not, I mean, that's some serious talent. So cable is attracting this kind of talent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you see Glenn Close on cable. You see, you know, Claire Danes, Emmy winners. You see all sorts of people because they have shorter runs. They have higher quality. It's just where you want to be.
Yes.
So we have a lot of new shows, though, on the networks that they have launched. How are they doing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't watch any of them. So frankly, I think they're all doing crappy. On ABC, you've got The Neighbors, which is on at Wednesday at 8:30. And I know somebody who thinks it's a creative train wreck.
Well, that was all the critics. I haven't watched it yet, actually.
Oh, okay.
It got such poisonous reviews, I didn't bother watching it. But it has. People thought it would be the first canceled show of the season, and it actually has not collapsed completely. It's part of that, you know, very strong ABC lineup, and it seems to be one of those sort of fake hits, one of those shows that can be protected by The Middle before it and Modern Family after it. And if it was on its own, it would collapse, and critics hate it. But it's not falling apart, so it may be around for a while.
Well, and later on Wednesday over on ABC at 10 p.m., you've got Nashville, which is kind of a bit of a, well, it's getting decent ratings, I suppose, not horrible ratings, 6.74 million viewers. So that'll probably be around for a while.
Nashville is probably one of the most acclaimed dramas of the new season. I found it too soapy for my taste. Though I like the country music. I like the singing. I like Connie Britton, who's the star. She's from Friday Night Lights. It also co-stars Hayden Panettiere. Some of the stuff in the pilot was so absurd and over the top. Hayden has a crack addict mom who calls her on the phone asking for money. And Connie Britton has to deal with her dad, Powers Booth, and all the machinations of her wealthy family. And it's just a little soapy for me. But if you're looking for soap with a bit of a country twang, that could be just the show for you.
Then you have Last Resort Thursdays at 8. I don't know. Where do we stand with this one?
That's also, I thought this was just, it sounded like a mini series to me. I thought, how is this a TV show that you expect to run for 4 or 5 years? This is the show about a rogue U.S. submarine, nuclear submarine, that hides out on an island and declares sovereignty And because there's been a sort of a coup in the U.S. government, a shadow coup. It's not official yet, I don't think. And they're holding their nuclear weapons hostage and saying they're going to be a counterbalance to this rogue force in the U.S. government. So it sounded like a premise for a miniseries at best, if not a movie. But it's supposed to be a long-running series. I watched a couple episodes. It's actually, they maintained the suspense and did a better job than I thought of stretching it out. I'm not going to watch it regularly, but it's okay. It's doing modestly in the ratings. It's not a big hit, but ABC hasn't had a, you know, it's sort of fading in Thursday with Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. So it's doing all right. It snagged some additional episodes, I believe. I think it might be back for season two, so you shouldn't feel too worried about it if you're watching this show.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's probably one show that I know is not going to be is, well, first of all, we can't even talk about Malibu Country because it's not even, it hasn't right. aired yet.
That's but, one more ABC show that's to come. That debuts on November 2nd.
Right. I don't think this 666 Park Avenue is going to be around long. I mean, I watched a portion of it this past Sunday and just was, my jaw was on the floor. I had no idea what this was about. I just thought, this is ridiculous, this show.
It's a very stupid show. It's done terrible in the ratings. It's DOA. So if you like it, don't fall in love with it. Revenge at 9 o'clock is doing fine, but 666 Park Avenue is just a collapse.
Well, and over on ABC, you have Dancing with the Stars, and which I guess plays opposite The Voice. Private Practice has been canceled. They canceled
right.
that.
This is the final season for Private Practice.
Right.
It's a shortened season, so you're going to get to see the finale of the show, but it ain't coming back.
And you mentioned Revenge is kind of a little bit of a quiet hit, and Once Upon a Time is also kind of falls into that category.
Yeah, Sundays 8 and 9 o'clock, they've had good success. 666 Park Avenue was going to build on that, sort of soapy, trashy fun, but it didn't pan out. But those other two will be around.
And Wednesdays, you know, Modern Family and Nashville now joins it. Thursdays, Grey's Anatomy. Well, I mean, it's not a new show, so I don't know why we're talking about it, but...
It's been around. It's a tired Thursday lineup. Last Resort at 8 is modest. Grey's Anatomy has been around a long, long time, and Scandal is in its second season. I don't think that's going to be around for a third. They just can't afford to have another, you know, fake hit like Private Practice was. For a long time, that aired behind Grey's Anatomy and survived simply because it was like a different world, you know, next to a Cosby show. These sort of spinoffs can survive in that safe hammock, but the network is sort of squandering that possibility of launching a genuine vital hit. And I don't think Last Resort is the answer there.
Well, let's jump to CBS. We have Partners, which is on at Monday at 8:30, and it's got 6.1 million viewers. It's the, you know, lowest rated comedy over on CBS, which means it's almost doomed because they always cancel their lowest rated comedy. You have Vegas, which is on at Tuesday at 10 p.m. You've said it's a huge hit. And I would imagine that has something to do with Dennis Quaid, who is featured in the show. What do you think of this show? Have you seen it?
I've watched everything, most shows. Vegas is fine. I won't watch it regularly. It's just, it's Vegas with, you know, good cops scoring off against the mob. It seems to be the story of, you know, there's a movie about Los Angeles with that coming out in the theaters in January. There's a movie, you know, there's L.A. Noir, which is coming out. We'll be talking about that later in the show, which is sort of the same story. This is that story about the cops versus the mob in Vegas. Stars Dennis Quaid as the good guy and Michael Chiklis as the bad guy. It's, you know, week to week, you've got Dennis Quaid solving crimes as the cowboy sheriff in Vegas as it comes into its own. And you've got Michael Chiklis as the mobster trying to muscle in and take over the town. It's, you know, it's just generic television.
Okay, so that's Vegas. Now, what about Elementary?
Well, that's the reboot of Sherlock Holmes. It's on Thursdays at 10. It's doing very well and should be around a long time. So if you're liking Elementary, relax. It and Vegas are going to be around for a while. If you saw Partners and are still liking it, don't get attached to that one. And if you saw Made in Jersey, a CBS drama about a young woman enjoying a big law firm,
then the head of CBS, would say, "You're the one."
Exactly. It's the first show this season to be canceled. There's always one. People have bets now on which show will be the first canceled. I think the winner was Neighbors. A lot of people thought the Neighbors on ABC would be that. But Made in Jersey is that crown, won that crown this year. So goodbye, Made in Jersey. Probably goodbye, Partners. Vegas and Elementary, if you're watching those shows, you're safe. They're going to be around for quite a while to come.
Well, what about over, well, we kind of talked a little bit about NBC, right?
Yeah, Revolution has a full season renewal. Go On and The New Normal also have full season renewals, though I've talked about the weakness that all of those have in the ratings. Animal Practice was the other big show they pushed during the Olympics. That's the second show of the season to be canceled. Guys with Kids is a show that came after Animal Practice, so the jury's still out on that because people can't quite tell how it's doing because it hasn't stood on its own yet.
Right, it had a pretty weak lead-in.
And then there's Chicago Fire from the people behind the Law & Order franchises. It's had a very strong hold on the lead-in of Law & Order SVU. It plays opposite Nashville, and Nashville is getting a lot of the heat and attention because it's doing a little bit better in the demos. But I think both of them could probably survive. So if you're watching Chicago Fire, I think you're going to be okay. And if you're watching Revolution go on in the new normal, those will all be here for at least this season. I imagine next year at least one or two of them will move into a new time period, and then we'll see if they can really sink or swim.
Well, I'm a little concerned for that monkey on Animal Practice. I mean, I don't know where he's going to get another job.
Well, he came out smelling like a rose. He'll be fine.
Okay. Well, okay. Then let's move on to Fox, where you have The Mob Doctor, because we need another television show about the mafia.
Well, this show is another pilot that was just pilloried and hated. It hasn't even aired yet, but people really think it's so DOA creatively that whenever it does air, it'll probably disappear quickly.
Well, and you have these two comedies, Ben and Kate, which I guess another six episodes were ordered. So it's kind of one of those questionable comedies where, well, do we really like it? We don't have anything else to put in its place, so we'll keep it around for a little while at least. And then you have The Mindy Project, which is Mindy Kaling. She's from The Office.
That got a full season renewal. They're high on that show. It's their best reviewed show of the season, without a doubt. I kind of like the tone of the show. I like the chemistry of the people. I like her. I like it when it stays rooted in reality. And she has a coworker, a male coworker, that they have a combative relationship with. I hope the idea is to keep them as friends and not, you know, this budding romance. I like them as friends. I don't want to see them get together necessarily. I think that would be too obvious for the show. I kind of like it. I'm not going to watch it regularly, but I think, you know, you're safe for that show. That's going to probably be back at least next year or so. I'm sure you've got that for a while behind you.
I like the way the friend is always bringing it up Springsteen.
Yeah, no, they have a good rapport. And I think they're sort of hinted a little bit of her feeling a little jealous about him when he's dating other women. And I don't like that.
Yeah.
I think they're really, it'd be a nice, refreshing thing to have them as friends with that little sort of under tension of sexual tension, but without it ever actually being what they act on. Yeah. You know, I don't think they're meant to be together. I think they're meant to be good friends.
Right. I mean, on the first show, she's like, you know, how does my outfit look? And, you know, she's asking all of her coworkers. And he says he doesn't like it. And she says, what do you mean? This outfit is hot. And he says, you know what would be hot? Lose 15 pounds.
Yeah. Oh, that was vicious. Exactly. And that was part of the fun of the show. It is a sort of a fresh spin to a degree on women and their self-image. Mindy Kaling, I think, is acute and appealing in it. And I kind of like it. It's not something I watch regularly. I'll dip into it, see how it's doing creatively. Maybe it'll get better. Maybe it'll get worse. But it's certainly one of the more intelligent sitcoms of the year.
So we've gone over CBS. We've gone over NBC. We've gone over ABC. I guess, I know you don't consider this a network, but there still is the CW.
Well, they've got a hit. So they think they're a network now. CW has probably the biggest out-of-the-box hit of the season. Vegas is the highest rated new drama on the network television. Obviously, The Walking Dead is the biggest hit in cable and the biggest hit overall by many standards. But I have to say, Arrow on the CW has just blown out of the box. They haven't had this big of a hit in years, not since The Vampire Diaries launched. It reached over 4 million viewers on its pilot. It held a lot of them for the second episode. It's an out-of-the-box hit. It was the most watched episode in 3 years. Forget pilot. It was the most watched episode, period. In 3 years on the CW, this network does barely exist. Show after show is struggling. 90210, on and on and on. They launched another show called Emily Owens MD, which had a very weak opening, but CW has so many problems, it'll probably stay around for the season. They launched Beauty and the Beast, which is just an absurd show. It's DOA, I think. But again, the CW has so little stuff on the shelf that they can bring in.
Yeah, what are they going to bring in, really?
It may last the season. So if you like Beauty and the Beast and Emily Owens, they may, in fact, last the entire season, even though neither one is successful. But Arrow, which is a silly show, it's bad. It's not silly in a good way. It's a stupid, stupid show. But by God, it's a hit. So that's going to be around for years to come.
All right, so that's a big deal then.
Absolutely, it's a very big deal.
All right, well then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Frank Darabont is back on TV. You know, speaking of The Walking Dead, as we did in our TV section, Director and producer Frank Darabont was the driving creative force behind the show's launch and its entire first season until he was summarily fired by AMC. The workload hasn't apparently frightened him off from TV, and rumors of him falling behind schedule haven't frightened off TNT because they're in the Frank Darabont business now. They've greenlit a period drama called L.A. Noir about the fight between cops and gangsters in the 40s and 50s that reunites Darabont with fellow Walking Dead alum like John Bernthal and From Heroes actor Milo, oh my goodness, how do you pronounce
it? Ventimiglia.
So Milo Ventimiglia. Darabont wrote and directed the pilot, and TNT ordered a total of 6 episodes to air in 2013. So is it a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. You know, if Frank Darabont couldn't place a pilot after being involved in The Walking Dead, I'd be shocked. But, you know, again, he had a bad experience with AMC. Clearly that hasn't tainted his reputation as far as an ability to create and launch a show. We'll have to see how he does down the road if it gets picked up and does well. But 6 episodes is a modest order. It's not 12. It's how The Walking Dead began. And it's probably an expensive period piece. So, you know, I'd say it's a big whoop. Guy gets job.
Okay, well then.
And the guy who created The Walking Dead gets job. If he didn't get picked up, that would be a big deal. If he couldn't ever place another show, then that would be a big deal and a bit of a head scratcher.
Well, this next story I don't think is a big deal, but we'll see. You know, it's another example of how book coverage is being affected by the release of actual sales figures. Arnold Schwarzenegger's memoir, Total Recall, debuted in October. Now, do you see what he did there? He was in a movie called Total Recall, and then his memoir is called Total Recall. Anyway, The Hollywood Reporter was able to say that sales are, quote-unquote, soft. In fact, the Schwarzenegger bio memoir, whatever you want to call it, it only sold 21,000 hardcover copies in its first week, despite a massive publicity push and Arnold doing the talk show circuit, and he was on The Daily Show. In comparison, the Navy SEAL memoir, I can't remember
Any Given Day, or what was that called?
The Tough Day, Hey, This Is Hard Work, If You Can Get It, I don't know. Well, it sold 254,000 copies, and J.K. Rowling sold 350,000 copies of her latest book, both in their first weeks. None of these totals include ebooks, and they don't cover all sales at non-traditional outlets, but they are telling and make for a valid comparison. Other celeb books did even worse, such as memoirs by Penny Marshall and Brat Packer Andrew McCarthy, which sold about 6,000 copies and 4,000 copies respectively so far. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
The Navy SEAL book is called No Easy Day.
Yeah, I knew it was something like, hey, this is tough, okay? Leave me alone.
And I think it's a big deal. Again, we're able to say this book could have opened at number one, and we just said, oh, Arnold has a number one book. But in fact, we know it opened very poorly, and it's not selling a lot of copies. And even we sort of buried the lead here. The Penny Marshall and Andrew McCarthy books are being released by Amazon, I believe. I know the Penny Marshall book is.
That's right.
Amazon launched this publishing arm, and all the bookstores said, we're not going to carry your book if you won't let us carry your ebooks, because Amazon wants to keep things exclusive. They say, hey, why don't you sell our hardcover book, but we won't let you sell our ebook. Well, everybody said, to heck with you. And that's certainly hurting hardcover sales, because that's very soft amount of money of sales for a book they spent a lot of money to snag. Every publisher wanted the Penny Marshall book. She went with Amazon, and now she's found out that when it comes to hardcover books, they're not able to turn her book into a hit. And is the reason the book didn't work? Or is it the fact that you couldn't walk into Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or any other book chain and find it? That's the reason that, you know, that certainly doesn't help. And she may regret the decision to go with Amazon.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, speaking of Andrew McCarthy, I was reading the LA Times and there was an article on Ireland in the travel section. And I'm reading this article and I'm like, who wrote this? Oh, a guy named Andrew McCarthy. Because he talks about, you know, being invited into, you know, people's homes in Ireland in the 80s when he first went to Ireland. And I went, wait, Andrew McCarthy, wow, you know, kind of like that actor guy. Well, it turns out it is that actor guy.
Well, everybody needs work.
He's a travel writer. I had no idea.
Oh, he does it all the time? It wasn't a one-off?
No, he's a travel writer.
Oh, well, more power to him.
Now, speaking of people with new jobs, Beyonce has a new one. The winner of this year's chance to perform at the Super Bowl halftime show and reach hundreds of millions of people is, of course, Beyonce. So on February 3rd, you can watch all those crazy commercials, watch another star sing the national anthem, see Beyonce in concert, and even catch a little football if you're inclined, you know, sports inclined, so to speak. Beyonce joins a list of superstars to do the gig, most recently Madonna, the Black Eyed Peas, and The Who. Guests will likely include her husband, you know, Jay-Z, possibly her former bandmates from Destiny's Child, and her new daughter, who her name, Blue Ivy, cannot be trademarked. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
What's that about copywriting a name?
Yeah, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce tried to trademark Blue Ivy, which is her daughter.
In general?
Yes.
Or as a name?
As, I don't know, in the through the trademark office.
Okay, I didn't hear about that. It's a big whoop. It's good for her, you know, whatever. She's got it, you know. Her album came out in 2011, so I don't think it'll really restart sales of her album four. She is making a documentary film about herself, which she is directing herself, which I find kind of fascinating. I didn't know about that until I looked up some information about the Super Bowl gig. So, provide some great footage for the movie, I guess. You know, and she is a new mother. Her daughter was born this January, so come next February, her daughter will be just over a year old. So that's nice. So she's had a busy, exciting year, but, you know, big whoop.
So basically, lots of men watching the Super Bowl, and here comes this woman who will be singing about single ladies.
Well, they'll be watching Beyonce and saying, darn, she looks good for having had a child just 1 year ago, and every pregnant mother will hate her.
Well, Warner Brothers, we talked about this a little bit last week. They just won this big ruling in the Superman copyright case. You know, as we mentioned last week, the heirs of the co-creator of Superman were kvetching over their decades-long battle with Warner Brothers having to do with Superman. Well, they faced a dose of kryptonite this week with a federal judge ruling against them by delivering a summary judgment for the studio in the latest round of legal tussles. The judge had seemed very favorable to the estate's claim of copyright, but ultimately decided that New York state law should apply in this instance and for various reasons, sided with the studio. Of course, the studio is elated, especially since they're in the midst of relaunching Superman with a new movie directed by Zack Snyder and produced by Christopher Nolan due next year. They can't be in any copyright wars. But it's just the latest round, and this case in various forms will continue in the courts for many years to come, mainly because, again, this is only one half of the creators of Superman that got kind of got ruled against. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I don't think it's a big whoop, but it's not because it's just the one half. This family, this estate, will be appealing the case. There are multiple venues in which they're working. It's not over yet. It's going to be going on for years to come. It's not that the other half is going to be suing. It's just that these people have various avenues of appeal. It's not the end of the story. It's definitely a major setback for them, however. But nonetheless, since we don't have a final ruling yet, I'll say it's a big whoop.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would have to side with the judge on this one. Effectively, Joe Shuster is one half of the creative team behind Superman. Now, when he passed away in, I think it was 1991 or 92, Gene Peavy, his sister, signed away all the rights to get one final big lump sum royalty payment. So Joe Shuster, one half, no longer has any rights. However, Jerry Siegel, who we were talking about last week, is the other co-creator, hasn't signed away any rights, and therefore the termination rights, that's the termination right battle that's going on there. So there's really two cases here.
This case is not over. I'm misunderstanding it then.
I don't know whether it's a single case or it should be two cases. It should be Joe Shuster's case and Jerry Siegel's case, both of whom have passed away, so it's their estate's cases. Now, in one instance, for Joe Shuster, the estate kind of signed away all rights. In the other case, Jerry Siegel, it did not. So it'll be interesting to see how it continues to play out. As you say, it will continue to play out. In any case, our next story is about AMC and Dish Networks. You know, those two best friends. Well, in a way, now they are best friends again. It's a win-win in this bitter fight between Cablevision and AMC on the one hand and the Dish Satellite Network on the other. Cablevision got $700 million in cash, and its channels will be carried by Dish. But Dish paid a lot less than some expected and can now start showing The Walking Dead so its subscribers will stop moaning. Get it? Moaning because there's a...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. The stocks of both companies hit 52 weeks highs on the news. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because now I don't have to watch any ads where AMC is catch The Walking Dead on every cable and satellite provider except Dish.
Yeah, or like Mad Men where they're like, you know, Dish subscribers can't watch Mad Men. Go rub
right.
It in their faces.
Right. It seemed like clearly everybody's happy it's over with both stocks rising to 52-week highs. You know, it's a good thing that they both put it behind them.
Newsweek is dead, however. The print magazine rival to Time has announced it will cease publication of a print edition and transition, quote unquote, their words, not ours, to an all-digital edition. And just to make sure no one reads it online, they're adding in a paywall. Subscriptions had fallen in half from 3.1 million in 2001 to 1.5 million just last year. The magazine was reportedly losing $40 million a year, which I hear is a great way to run a business, by the way. So after 79 years, Newsweek will cease its print edition at the end of the year. Big deal or big whoop? Can we move on? Because it's kind of a big deal.
It's a very big deal. You know, it's been around for 80 years. It's dead. The news magazine almost has no purpose anymore, thanks to online and 24-hour cable channels. Nobody has to wait for Time to weigh in on what is the big story of the week. What's going to be on the cover of Time? That used to be an exciting proposition. No more. Now that everybody else has fallen by the wayside, that might give Time a few extra years. But I can't imagine. It just doesn't serve any purpose anymore. Newsweek going online and putting up a paywall? Please. How many people are going to follow them? Who cares anymore? The Daily Beast is going to eat the owner and be whatever survives will be on the Daily Beast, which is a separate, you know, online version of Newsweek. And I just don't see it having any long-term life.
Yeah, you know, Daily Beast run by Tina Brown. But, well, why don't I shuffle the stories up a bit so we can stick with magazines? Because the question is, to paywall or not to paywall? And as I just said, that is the question. The answer, according to Rolling Stone, is to not paywall. Sort of. At least not all the time, and especially if someone will pay for it. That equivocal answer, worthy of Hamlet, comes after years of Rolling Stone restricting access to its massive archive of articles only to subscribers and those who pay for all access to its website. Now they're launching artist timelines, starting with Bruce Springsteen, Green Day, the Rolling Stones, and the like, that will give anyone full access to the archives of, you know, of an act, so Beyonce maybe. It's been sponsored by the music streaming service Ardio for 3 months, which means now Rolling Stone can make money off of it more directly and have those articles be found via web searches, driving traffic to the site. They hope to expand it ultimately to every act, like maybe Beyonce, with perhaps artists themselves sponsoring a timeline when they go out on tour and so on. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but I think it's a big deal historically. If you're looking up an old article in the New York Times or somebody else and you weren't a subscriber, you'd find out, oh, you couldn't get access to it. If you wanted to see it, you'd have to pay a buck or two. And it was very annoying and bizarre to me. I thought, you've got this huge archive of information and that can drive massive amounts of traffic to your website. Why would you restrict it to people? Seems to me that the new stuff is the stuff that you might want to paywall, if at all, because it's the new timely stuff that people have to get access to and want access to the new edition of the New York Times. But an article from 1984, an article from 1972, to paywall that, to me, made no sense whatsoever. So Rolling Stone had the same issue, where, like, you've got dozens of feature stories of Bruce Springsteen, reviews of his first album when it came out, reviews of his second album, concert reviews from 1975. You know, why have all that behind a paywall when people casually looking up Bruce Springsteen online, bring them to your website, get them excited, draw traffic, and maybe show them the great work you have, and they'll want to subscribe.
That's right.
To me, those archives are more valuable when they're free and open, and it's the newest stuff that if you're going to paywall at all, that's where you should do it.
Well, MGM has delayed its initial public offering again. The studio, which I'm shocked is still around, hopes to raise a massive $3 billion to bankroll itself, even though in recent years, most of the time, it's let other studios shoulder the burden of bankrolling the majority of its slate, limiting the studio's downside and, of course, limiting its upside. This isn't the first time MGM has pushed back the IPO. Normally, that happens because a company is nervous, but this time it's because MGM is actually excited. First, it arranged the IPO for right before the release of the new Bond film Skyfall, which Sony and Eon are actually releasing, by the way. Then they decided it was going to be so big they would do it after Skyfall came out. Well, you know, based on the early reviews, that's probably not a bad idea. Now they're delaying it again till early next year so investors can see the success of Skyfall and, guess what, a little film that Michael might be looking forward to called The Hobbit.
Gandalf.
Of course, Warner Brothers is actually releasing The Hobbit and will reap most of those rewards, but MGM will be cheering them on and hopes the success of these films will mean investors want to make their IPO a success. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's fascinating. They keep pushing this back, saying, ooh, we'll put it before Skyfall. We'll put it between Skyfall and The Hobbit. We'll wait for both Skyfall and The Hobbit to come out. And you've seen studio stock sometimes go up or down because of a release of an individual film, which always seemed very short-sighted to me. In this case, it just seems bizarre. MGM's entire strategy the last few years, to me, is disproven by the success of Skyfall and The Hobbit. Since they couldn't take the chance, they couldn't make these movies happen on their own, they had to let other people make them and reap most of the rewards. So to my mind, they're saying, hey guys, look what movies we failed to profit hugely from. Give us more money. It just seems a bizarre argument in my mind. It's just crazy.
We'd like you to invest in us, and to prove it, we will prove how poorly we are managed.
Exactly. We didn't make The Hobbit. We let someone else make it, but we'll get 2% of the deal. And we didn't make Skyfall, but by God, wouldn't it be great if we had? But we'll see. Maybe investors are stupid. They'll say, oh, look at those movies did well. MGM is linked to them. Let's give them a lot of money.
Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, I don't see how this story could affect our listeners any more if it tried. This is a story, and it's really a series of stories, or multiple stories, one in The Hollywood Reporter by Eric Gardner, another in The Wall Street Journal by Jennifer Waters. It's really about whether we own our digital media, the CDs and the DVDs that we buy, not to mention the MP3s and musical tracks that we purchase. So,
and Michael, books.
And books, of course, ebooks. So fill us in, Michael. Do we own these? And if not, am I stealing them? I don't get it.
Well, we don't know yet. The companies we buy them from have everybody sign a release or sign off on a waiver saying you don't own them, that you're just licensing those books, you're just licensing the music, you're just licensing those digital copies of the movies that you get. However, there are two court cases we have our eyes on, and these are sort of teaser articles to say, hey, pay attention to these court cases. They're coming out, and they'll give us a better indication of where we stand.
So the court cases are coming out like a movie?
That's right. Okay. The first court case comes out on October 29th. The U.S. Supreme Court will be hearing oral arguments in a case involving textbooks. What happened was a student from, where was he? I think he was from Thailand, but I'm not sure. A young student came to the U.S. for school, and he looked at the price of the textbooks and said, oh my God, these are really expensive. Oh no, yeah, he's from Thailand. And he asked his friends back home to send him those textbooks, which are available in Thailand. He said, buy them there, send them to me, because they're a lot cheaper. You know, they're like, say, $20 in Thailand and $100 or $150 in the U.S. He said, so buy me my, here are my textbooks, buy them and mail them to me, and that'll be cheaper than me buying them in the U.S. So they did that, and then a light bulb went off, and he said, hey, actually, send me 100 copies of those books.
Right.
And he sold them around to other people, started making thousands, tens of thousands, quite a bit of money, reselling those textbooks that they bought legally in Thailand. Now, that's generally considered fair use, but
it's the first sale doctrine, at least here in the U.S., where if you buy a book, you have the right to resell it once. You know, you're the first sale.
Right. And the publishers say, not when you're shipping it from overseas, because they say this will upend our business. That means that the lowest price anywhere in the world will become the lowest price everywhere in the world, to which I say, welcome to globalization. Yeah. So this has gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and it's going to be a fascinating example to see what will happen. You know, does this mean that you can't resell anything? You know, the consumers say, you know, you can't strangle the resale, Margaret. What about books for toys for tots? And you're giving away to. I'm sure the publishers would say, hey, we can make an exception for charitable cases. But in general, you can't ship thousands of books in from overseas just to undercut our sales price here in this country.
Certainly not without paying a tariff. I mean, you have to pay an import duty, right?
Well, I'm sure he paid whatever appropriate fees were, you know, that's not the issue, I don't think.
Right.
The issue is whether he can do it at all.
Okay.
But simply put, historically, if you buy an iPhone, you get to resell it. If you buy a copy of that Navy SEAL book, No Easy Day, and you've got a hard copy of it, you can sell it. You can sell it on eBay. You can turn it into a used bookstore. You can give it away to your friends. None of that is apparently eligible for digital copies. That's what the publishers say. You don't own that book. You're just renting it. You're licensing it. You're allowed to look at it until we pull back that license. So you can't resell it. And that's where this other case comes in. There's a separate case in federal district court that a judge is about to hand down a decision on. We don't know when.
So it's not being heard like this other case. This other case is just going before the Supreme Court.
It's going to the Supreme Court. It's going all the way to the Supreme Court. This other case has been heard, and we're about to get a ruling any day now from the judge. It's Capitol Records versus Redigi. Well, I think I'm saying that
Redigi,
right.
Redigi, yeah. Yeah. This is Redigi. This company is – okay, go ahead.
Yeah. It's a company that set up the business, I think we talked about them, where they let you resell your digital songs or albums. say you bought the Beyonce album 4 digitally. They create this locker system where you put your copy of the album there in a way, and then someone else buys the right to access that copy and gets their own, reselling your digital copy, just like you might take a CD to a store. The music company says, hey, you don't own that digital copy. You can't do that. You can't resell it because you're only licensing it. And they say, no, it's just like a CD. We've come up with this system. That means you won't have access to it anymore, but they will. It's fair use. You can do it. And this case has gone up to federal courts, and they're going to have a ruling any day now about whether the first sale doctrine does or does not apply to digital goods.
This kind of ruling, this kind of case, well, actually, let's face it, I agree with you. It's going to go all the way to the Supreme Court because it affects so many different markets.
Well, I don't know if this particular case is good enough or is the right case to take to the Supreme Court.
Well,
but
good
I think
point.
Some case will. You pay $50,000 for music over your lifetime, and suddenly you find out you cannot give your children your digital library. They can't even get access to it without, you know, sort of stealing your password and pretending to be you. You buy hundreds of movies, spend tens of thousands of dollars on movies, but sorry, you're out of luck. You can't give them away. You've got digital books, but you can't even, you know, loan them to a friend or give away your copy or sell it. You know, this is, it's a technical issue as far as how to do it.
But it's also a legal issue. And, you know, for some.
Well, is there a legal issue? I say no. I say there isn't. There's a very close very clear history. You buy a book, you can resell it when you're done with it. All right. Digital copies mean it's a little trickier. You have to work out a system. And the publishers don't want to do that. The companies don't want to do that because they don't want to, they want to pretend you suddenly have lost that right. They said, oh, you didn't buy that book. You're just borrowing it. It's like, no, no, I bought it. You can tell me I didn't buy it, but it's bull.
Yeah, and that's the same thing with software. It's, you know, you never really purchase software. You might buy it, okay, but you're really only buying a license for it. And that's been, well, you know, widely known that you're only buying a license for it. So technically, you can't go on eBay and sell it. In fact, eBay sometimes sends people who are trying to sell, you know, sell their software, they send them takedown notices.
I assume historically there wasn't a long period where people could resell their software the way there is with books, music, and DVDs, right?
Well, yeah, that's true.
Right. So, but that may have been illegal from the start, and that probably shouldn't stand. If I buy a copy of Windows and I want to buy the new copy and sell the old copy, why shouldn't I be able to?
Well, and in times this kind of rule, this licensing rule actually helps people. I know that I've done research work where the report that's issued is not sold to different people, but licensed to them. Now, why is it licensed? So that the particular company and or individual purchasing the report when they're, you know, industry reports, they can't turn around and sell it to somebody else and say, well, yes, I paid $2,000 for this market research, but I'm going to sell it to my friend for $1,000. So I only paid $1,000 for it. So, you know, that really helps groups that do market research because, you know, there isn't a black market or a secondary market for research papers.
Well, what's the difference between that and buying a book? It's more valuable. It costs more to create, just like an art book or whatever. But what's the difference?
That's a good question.
The price?
Well, I know that one is a consumer good.
They're all unique offerings. You know, if I create a book with, I do years of research, you know, I've spent a lot of money to create this unique book. I say, well, why should you get to resell it again? I spent 10 years writing this book about World War II. There's new information not available anywhere else, just like your research document. How come you get to sell my, you can't sell that research document, but you can sell my book that I spent 10 years working on?
I don't know. That's a good question.
It's nice for the companies, but it's not necessarily, you know, legal. Has anyone ever challenged it before? I don't know. The point is there's a very practical world where what we're talking about is books and music and movies, and there's a long history of people buying and reselling them. There's no reason why that should have changed just because it's now a digital copy, and they've gotten away with pretending, oh no, the rules are different now. There's one little interesting caveat here. Random House, in the last few weeks, has repeatedly and clearly told libraries, when libraries buy an ebook version of a book, they are buying the book. Now, there's various reasons why they're saying this, various reasons why they're trying to make nice and calm down the libraries, but everybody knows they've been told you're buying a license, you're buying a license, you're buying a license, you're not really buying a copy of the book, you're just buying the right to access that book. Random House has explicitly told libraries, okay, no, you guys are actually buying the book.
Well, then I'm a library. How about that?
Right, and libraries are very excited by that because that helps clear up a lot of issues that they have as far as storing books and making them archived and available for generations to come, which is a very interesting issue for digital books versus a physical copy. And you can't have it both ways. you know, you've got record labels saying, oh, no, when we sell it to consumers, we're licensing it. But no, when we're giving royalties to artists, it's actually not a license. It's just a sale. You've got Random House telling consumers, no, no, you didn't buy that book. You licensed it. But telling libraries, no, you didn't license that book. You bought it. So they're trying to get advantage and use whatever works best in whatever situation. And you can't have it both ways. And that's what they're doing right now. And the simple idea that you could spend, buy thousands of books in your lifetime, and they have to just disappear, and you can't give them to your children or sell them or do anything with them, is absurd. Maybe it'll disappear if we have digital libraries and everyone just streams everything and accesses the world libraries for a flat monthly fee. But when people want to purchase something and they have, they should have the right to resell them. I hope the Supreme Court rules the right way.
Well, and I wonder what our listeners think. And you know what? You could let me know because you can email us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, there are other ways to stay in touch with us. You could follow us on Twitter. Our username on Twitter is ShowbizSandbox. You could like us on Facebook. You could come and see what we post on our Facebook page, where our username is, ironically, ShowbizSandbox. But really, we hope that you subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher, or really wherever podcasts are given away for free. That's where you can subscribe to us. And please do rate and review the show.
And give copies to your friends.
Yes, give as many copies to your friends as possible. We don't have any of this licensing madness that is going on in with books and music and movies. Now, you know, all of this information, ways to follow us, ways to subscribe to the show, ways to email and contact us, all of that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, that website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, when he's not writing for the Huffington Post and other media outlets, he has a website. It is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I have no joke to make.